governments will need to do more with less. There seems to be an emerging consensus that we are indeed in a new era. We are in a new and perhaps lasting global economic order, and that these realities are likely not to change, at least in the near to medium term.
In today's episode of Multilateralism Unpacked, we explore how the landscape of development assistance is being transformed. Budget cuts and market turmoil have precipitated a funding crisis with far-reaching consequences for the global south. There is now less money going around to different places and for different priorities. The future of development assistance was at the forefront of discussions at the recent IMF and World Bank spring meetings in Washington, D.C. To help us understand the mood in D.C. and the proposals being put forward to help the development sector navigate the challenges ahead, I spoke to Dr. Nicole Golden, Head of Equitable Development at UNU-CPR. Previously a lead economist at the World Bank, Nicole is well positioned to offer informed insights on what the financial sector is thinking and how the development sector should respond to a new era of declining development assistance. Here's our interview. Nicole, you were just in Washington, D.C. for the spring meetings of the IMF and World Bank. I'm curious to know what the general tone of conversation was regarding declining development assistance and recent market turmoil.
Well, it's great to be with you, Jack, to have this conversation. Thank you. I would say on the outside of 19th Street, where the two International Monetary Fund and World Bank headquarter buildings sit across from each other, it certainly seemed more subdued with, for example, notably less signage on the headquarters and other buildings than years past. Inside the halls, though, the mood was definitely dark and somber, especially at the beginning of the week and after the release of the IMF's World Economic Outlook on the Tuesday morning, which projected downgrades across the board for all regions and income groups. Very few countries received good news. That said, the debate and the dialogue and likely the behind-the-scenes deal-making that I didn't see felt as robust as they have the past decade or so that I've been attending and participating in the meetings. This includes, I would say, the unofficial program and side events, which were numerous, if not more, than they've ever been. The Atlantic Council alone, for example, where I'm a non-resident senior fellow, hosted 45 events from its headquarters and live studio inside the IMF. And by the end of the week, I'd say there did seem to be a bit more light in the air, so to speak. Not least of which because U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, while critical of what the administration sees as mission creep by both Bretton Woods institutions, signaled, if not stated, in his Wednesday speech that America would stay in both the World Bank and the IMF, subject, of course, to them getting back to basics and reforming.
So you mentioned that there was a bit more light in the air towards the end of the week that you were in D.C. Nevertheless, development will still be impacted by recent policy shifts and declining ODA commitments across the board. Can you just give us a sense of what some of the repercussions will be of these decisions to slash development assistance for the global south and really for those dependent on the development sector?
I don't think we can adequately estimate right now what the full effect of the cuts will be, but we do know that lives and livelihoods are very much at stake. There are already news accounts and reports of immediate threats to health and risk of fatalities as vaccines, medicines, or emergency food were delayed or withheld. For example, one report that's already out said that the U.S. cuts alone could risk up to 18 million additional cases of malaria a year and a million cases of severe or potentially fatal childhood malnutrition. Similarly, in the health space, despite years of progress, HIV infections could rise over 600% if the support that the U.S. had been giving isn't replaced, and famine could spread. There was early on in the cuts a report that as much as $500 million of life-saving and life-sustaining food assistance was at risk of spoilage, delay, or diversion. So no doubt the tangible damages are and will continue to accrue, and the economic toll as well will rise. But there will be intangible impact and costs as well, and we're seeing that sort of beyond this, the long-term risk to delivery and effectiveness of programs and funding as local organizations are forced to disband and data and evidence are lost. This harm to the implementation architecture, if you will, especially in the most challenging environments, those that are, for example, conflict or conflict affected, fragile, or even climate affected, will be lasting and unlikely to be easily rebuilt, even if and when funding levels increase again. So that's something we really need to keep our eye on, both the immediate term as well as the fact that the long-term repercussions are going to be, I don't think we can even really measure at this point in time.
You wrote a blog several weeks ago on the CPR website. The blog was about how you felt the development sector could navigate this new context. And you argued that there are three main options to consider. One is looking across themselves and each other. The other is looking within. The third is looking to the multipliers. Perhaps you could just break those three options down.
Sure. Thanks, Jack. I'll say, going back to the meetings for a minute, that I was pleased to hear these ideas reinforced and resonated in many of my conversations and in what I heard. So glad to have the chance to unpack this a little bit here now. When I talk about leaders looking across themselves and to each other, I'm referring to the need for better cooperation and coordination between and among bilateral and multilateral donor agencies, between donors and their development partner governments, and between public and private sector actors. Looking within is really about domestic resource mobilization, increasing the tax base by increasing economic participation and financial inclusion. And this is in particular including among women and youth who tend to have lower labor force participation rates and less access to startup financing. So they're less able to financially and economically engage and generate that revenue. But it's also about better tax collection administration. This is where the international support comes in, as well as better combating illicit financial flows and leakage, and also tapping into the remittances and speeding up the flow of remittances, which we know are actually a significant source of revenue, if you will, of money flow back into many of these countries, in some cases more than official development assistance. So that's really important. And when I talk about looking to the multipliers, this is encouraging leaders to invest and innovate in what we know works to multiply development effectiveness, equity, and impact. And let me highlight three things here quickly. Localization, which is about aligning support with national strategies, program co-creation and ownership, funding local actors, and in-country spending and increasing the use of local systems. So we really find that sustainability and durability of localization can help amplify effectiveness and spread dollars better. Now, this also gets back to that point I made. One of the long-term repercussions of the funding cuts is that many of these local delivery organizations are being forced to disband in the immediate term. That poses a challenge. But again, if done right, localization can really be a multiplier and an amplifier. Another one is that data and data ecosystems, which have been found to have quite stunning return on investment, actually. One study that I saw showed that investing in data systems can bring a return of $32 in effectiveness for every $1 spent. I mean, that can really be game-changing and really the impact in terms of helping to understand needs and to better design program and policies to enable early warning systems and data ecosystems can help increase accountability. All of these things can again help increase reach, scale, and impact of more limited resources. And last, but you know, certainly not least, worth highlighting is just the impact of digital technology, artificial intelligence, and digital tools, and how they can increase productivity, they can reduce costs, they can spur innovation and product development, and in doing so, expand the reach and scale of development interventions. Now, the caveat here that must be noted is that user protection, the potential unequal access and other risks will need to be managed when thinking about digital tools, but if used effectively, again, can really be a game changer in development effectiveness and doing more with less, so to speak.
As you mentioned previously in the interview, a lot of the ideas that you were talking about, the ideas that you've just spoken about, resonated with people at the spring meetings in DC. And I was just wondering if you could give some other examples of, you know, what were some of the onward solutions being proposed in DC at the meetings?
There's a few things to mention as far as key outcomes and takeaways from both the official and the unofficial proceedings go. One rather celebrated item, for example, at least by those behind it was the release by the Global Sovereign Debt Roundtable, which is co-chaired by the World Bank, the IMF, and the G20, of a restructuring playbook, if you will. It was designed to inform and guide debtors through the restructuring process, making it more transparent, potentially faster, and thus more attractive. So that's a good thing. But also, because it was a consensus document by the creditor countries, this really is a notable achievement and worthy of noting success. That said, given the intensity of the debt challenge and the limitations it is putting on fiscal space, many see this as a welcome tool, though the call for more concrete relief still remains quite loud. On the World Bank side, many deem the singular prioritization on and announcements related to jobs as a success of the meetings, including the expansion of the private sector investment lab. Jobs, especially for youth, has long been a priority for the bank. It's something I worked on there as lead economist of the Solutions for Youth Employment Coalition. But this time, it does seem different. It does seem that the full orientation will move the needle, and that is seen as a success given how, again, important jobs are to everything we've been talking about. But given how fraught with anxiety the meetings were, many people deemed them a success by the simple fact that people showed up and seemed ready and willing to talk to, and perhaps more importantly, listen to each other. At an Atlantic Council event towards the end of this week, Spanish Finance Minister Carlos Crespo said that the most important deliverable was simply for people to, quote, keep talking to each other. I think it also seemed more intent to do more than talk, but to act, and that's important. Along those lines, and more broadly speaking, one outcome I heard is the recognition that governments will need to do more with less. This is kind of speaking to the multipliers that I just talked about. And similarly, I'd say, and this maybe especially refers to the offsite conversations, there seemed to be an emerging consensus that we are indeed in a new era. We are in a new and perhaps lasting kind of global economic order, and that these realities are likely not to change, at least in the near to medium term. And I think that really does, you know, call for a new narrative. I wrote about this in the blog as well. I've said that the new realities will require a renewed sense of purpose, pace, priority, and precision. And I think I heard that coming out of the meetings as well.
So we're looking forward to a very packed agenda over the coming months with several events and UN policy processes unfolding. So can you talk us through those upcoming events and processes and perhaps identify where you see opportunities for securing finance for the world's poorest countries?
Yes, we went straight from the spring meetings into preparatory events for the fourth conference on financing for development, which will be in Sevilla, Spain, commencing June 30th. So just 7 or 8 weeks from now as we sit here today. It is an event that happens every 10 years, the last one in 2015 in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And it's an important process. It's a really important moment. And there is greater realization that the, quote, billions to trillions, which was the mantra coming out, the idea of the, dare I say, commitments coming out of Addis Ababa, is just not going to be realized. There is a estimated anywhere between $4 to $7 trillion shortfall in financing to achieve the sustainable development goals and other investment needs. So this is an opportunity. This is a moment. There is an increasing sense of urgency and realization that, as I said, this is a moment. And what we're seeing and hearing out of what we call the PrepComs, the preparatory committees, the fourth one was this one just the other week after the spring meetings, as well as from the other kind of ongoing negotiations about the outcome document itself, is that we could see small but not insignificant commitments in the text, for example, around the evolving credit rating agencies, credit ratings ecosystem, I should say, which really is critical to that private sector investment and towards debt. We could see some movements and some reforms around the debt architecture itself, as well as around domestic resource mobilization, which I talked about, including potential commitments or processes around mobilization, domestic resource mobilization and tax cooperation, but also development cooperation in and of itself. And here we could see, again, the opening of some new processes within the UN that could better align UN and Washington, so to speak, but also better align the donor community. So this is a real opportunity to see some actual tangibles in the text itself, but there's also the potential that Sevilla could really be a beginning in and of itself, if you will, with new initiatives announced, actual sort of concrete initiatives that will bring programs, policies, things on the ground, including under the much hyped Sevilla Platform for Action, cleverly acronymed the SPA for short, and the International Business Forum that is being organized alongside the official events. And again, that is going to bring the private sector, bring civil society as well to Sevilla, to this moment, and hopefully with it bring, you know, the resources, the initiatives, and the beginning of what would come. I would also note that given the significant climate development nexus, it's worth mentioning that the UN Climate Conference, COP30, to be held in Belém in November, that process is also unfolding. It will be a big opportunity to see movement on increasing the availability, affordability, and access to climate finance, especially for the small island developing states and other vulnerable developing countries. So this will be critical to augment their ability to invest in mitigation, adaptation, and resilience, all of which are integral to achieving development objectives. So it's a busy few months, as you said, and we are here engaging in all of it.
That was Dr. Nicole Golden, Head of Equitable Development at UNUCPR, on the recent spring meetings in Washington, D.C., and looking ahead to FFD4 in Sevilla at the end of July. So a lot happening over the coming months regarding climate finance and international financial architecture reform. We'll be following developments closely. Thank you for listening.